Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, now accepting applications for a wide range of job and career opportunities at the hospital and outpatient offices across the greater Saratoga region. SaratogaHospital.org/careers. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. If you have a question about anything gastroenterology related, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can email your question to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and I will say the name properly throughout the show, comes up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is gastroenterologist Dr. Jennifer Northrup. Board certified in gastroenterology, Dr. Northrup is a member of the American Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, the American College of Gastroenterology, and the American Gastroenterological Association. Dr. Northrup practices all aspects of general gastroenterology and has an interest in functional gastrointestinal disorders, colorectal cancer, and wireless small bowel capsule endoscopy. She's been a member of the Albany Gastroenterology Consultants team since 2013. She completed additional training in radio frequency ablation for Barrett's esophagus and in the interpretation of wireless capsule endoscopy of the small bowel. If you have a question for Dr. Northrup, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Long introduction for Dr. Jennifer Northrup. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray, for having me.
So nice to have you here. First, in your bio, and it was extensive, we talked about radio frequency ablation for Barrett's esophagus. Explain that procedure and why it is helpful.
Sure. So Barrett's esophagus is basically a complication of chronic GERD or gastroesophageal reflux disease, where the lining of the esophagus changes to look more like the lining of the stomach, which, if you think about it, is a cool adaptive mechanism of the body with one exception. When that lining changes, it opens the door to further change, which can be malignant. Additional change of Barrett's esophagus is a type of change we call dysplasia. That dysplasia increases the risk of adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. When we see that dysplasia occur, then we can perform radiofrequency ablation, or RFA, to obliterate that dysplastic change of the tissue and prevent the additional further change to esophageal adenocarcinoma.
But how do you, and we've talked about this with radiation oncologists as well, how do you target just those cells and not other things you don't want to change?
Right. So there's two different features that are at the bottom of the scope when we do Barrett's ablation. One is a little square. It looks like a chiclet, like a piece of chiclet gum, and we can push it right up against the area that we measure to know that we're targeting those specific tissues. We also have a balloon, so when we have Barrett's tissue that is more circumferential, we can expand that balloon and target that area. We measure in centimeters the level of the Barrett's esophagus in the esophagus, so we can target as closely as possible, not 100% guarantee, but as closely as possible to deliver our treatment most effectively.
We're joined today by gastroenterologist Dr. Jennifer Northrup. And how many people do you think in this country suffer from some level of reflux?
Oh, the majority.
Really?
I think that every human being has had some degree of a reflux symptom at some point in their life. But I believe that actual gastroesophageal reflux disease, definitely the majority of people, not forever, but at least for some point of their life.
Hmm. You know, your description of what happens in Barrett's esophagus, I have never heard, and maybe you can't answer this question, but maybe you have a theory. Why would the esophagus change those cells to be more like the stomach cells?
So the lining of the esophagus is more delicate, whereas the lining of the stomach is hardier and aimed to protect against the acidic stomach contents, the low pH. we're not designed to have very acidic contents sitting in our esophagus all the time. So when we have reflux, the esophagus recognizes, I'm going to have a lot of acid coming up. I'm going to change my lining to look more like the stomach, to be harder and protect against that acid. So it is very interesting that it's trying to adapt to its harder relative, the stomach.
Yeah.
But that unfortunately opens up the change to further concern.
You know, pH being an important factor here, in other words, acid coming back up is what we're talking about.
Correct.
Here. In the old days, in the days of my father, hey, Dad, I got some indigestion. Take some Alka-Seltzer, take some Tums, lower that, raise the pH.
Correct.
When you take something like a prescription or over-the-counter, something like omeprazole, one of those classes, that is not really lowering the pH. It's doing something else, right?
Correct. So omeprazole is what we call a PPI or a proton pump inhibitor, which is the most effective class of medications we have to treat acid reflux. What that does is it blocks a percentage of the proton pumps in the stomach, which are responsible for secreting gastrin or the acid that lowers the pH. And so we're, you know, blocking those pumps to prevent the acid from coming out. Not 100%, because we do need some acid to help digest food, but a portion of them so that we're not getting, you know, as acidic contents as possible. So that when you're refluxing things, we're trying to make it more alkaline than acidic.
When, for a long period of time, those type of medications were only prescription. Now you can get lighter doses right over the counter at your pharmacy.
Correct.
Are Americans taking too many of them?
Well, I think the warning on the box is appropriate. It says to take for 14 days, and if your symptoms persist after you complete that, you should see a doctor. And I definitely agree with that, because you could be missing a more chronic or concerning condition by just taking it back to back to back. So while they may be appropriate long term, it really is important for a physician, specifically a gastroenterologist, to make sure that you're treating the right condition and that you're on the right amount, the right dosage, check for side effects, and that really should be done annually.
But some people are on them literally for life.
That's correct.
We are joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrop of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to the emails and the phone calls in a moment. But first, this small bowel capsule endoscopy is something I have not heard of. I assume you're putting a little radio transmitter in something that someone swallows, and you are good at interpreting the data you get. Are you getting pictures? What are you getting?
Right. So what happens with small bowel capsule endoscopy is the patient swallows a capsule. It's about the size of a jelly bean. It has a camera in there. After they swallow it, there are leads attached to their chest, much like an EKG, and they wear a battery pack clipped to their waistband. The battery life of the capsule is about 8 hours. They go out. They have a normal day. While they're out and about, that little capsule is in there taking a multitude of pictures as it's rotating, which are then compressed into a video file, downloaded, and then at the conclusion of the battery life, I read that, and it's compressed so I can read it like a video.
And you, basically, you're looking at this video, and what can you learn that you couldn't learn from standard methods?
Sure. So a standard GI workup depends on what we're working up, what diagnosis we're working up, consists of an upper endoscopy where we examine the esophagus, stomach, and the first portion of the small intestine, what we call the duodenum, which is the first 12 inches of the small intestine, and a colonoscopy, which looks at the entire colon or large intestine, and frequently the very bottom part of the small intestine, the terminal ileum.
So top and bottom.
Correct. But connecting those areas is many, many feet of small intestine, and we don't have scopes really long enough easily to look at that entire area. So a lot of times we don't get our answer by upper endoscopy and colonoscopy, and we need to look at the remaining intestine. And this gives us a way to look where no one's ever looked before. And I find it very powerful because I've been able to make diagnoses that otherwise we would not have seen. We can see lesions that are causing blood, causing active bleeding to make the patient anemic. I've diagnosed malignancies. I've diagnosed Crohn's disease, which is a type of inflammatory bowel disease that only exists in the small bowel. And if you don't look in the small bowel, you won't see it. So it's really an important tool for a complete gastrointestinal evaluation.
So this was a game changer, this
game
technology.
Changer. Absolutely.
What did you do before that? Not you. Obviously, you're
right.
Probably you have been in this profession as long as this technology has been in this profession. But what did doctors do 50 years ago?
Didn't diagnose those things.
Ah.
People would have unexplained abdominal pain, keep returning. People would say, I don't know what's going on. And it's probably because, you know, they could have had Crohn's disease in the small bowel and no one knew it.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup. And if you have a question, this is the time to get in line. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It is a Medical Monday, and we're joined today by gastroenterologist Dr. Jennifer Northrup. And I will struggle to not say Northrup. And so far, so good. Right, Doc?
You're doing wonderfully, Ray.
All right, let's go with a few emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Barbara. I had my first episode of diverticulitis a month ago. Felt like labor pains. Confirmed with an abdominal CT, treated by liquid diet and BRAT, which you'll have to tell me what that is. How do I get back to my normal diet of fiber and nuts? And that's from Barbara.
Well, the other question I have is, was Barbara treated with antibiotics for diverticulitis?
Don't know.
Okay.
Doesn't say.
So typically after diverticulitis, that's an inflammation of an outpouching or a pocket in the colon, what we call diverticuli. And when one of those pockets becomes inflamed, that's what causes diverticulitis. The concern is that that inflammation can worsen and actually perforate, which can, you know, be an emergency and require surgery. So we like to calm down the inflammation, which we typically do with a low residue or low fiber diet. Sometimes, you know, we call that the BRAT diet, which is bananas, rice, apples, and tea, to kind of give the gut a little bit of a rest.
Yeah.
However, if you have diverticulitis, it is important to get back to a high fiber diet because high fiber can actually prevent further episodes of diverticulitis. It's a very healthy diet for the colon. We want to avoid constipation, and a high fiber diet can do that. It definitely should be done slowly. Usually I recommend after a week or two of antibiotics. If Barbara didn't take antibiotics, if she's a month out, it's perfectly fine to initiate going back to a high fiber diet. She can work up to it slowly. I also recommend that if she did take antibiotics, to take a probiotic, good bacteria to help repopulate the gut flora for about a month after that treatment. And I certainly would recommend a colonoscopy after an episode of diverticulitis if one hasn't been done in the recent past.
But if you get it once, you're likely to get it again?
Correct. The incidence does increase, although the majority of people will have a single episode and they will never have another episode.
Okay. Well, let's go to the next one. I had some more questions about that, but we'll come back to that. We have a lot of callers on the line. This is from Amy. Amy says, haven't there been studies showing long-term use of omeprazole can lead to dementia?
No. That was actually disproved. That initial study had come out. It was not what we call a good quality study. It was not a large, double-blind, randomized controlled trial. The three large gastrointestinal societies in the country did do trials such as that, which takes several years, and it came out that there was no link to dementia from PPIs.
Are they still looking at this in the long term? Or
not to my knowledge.
So it's settled science as far as your field is concerned.
Correct.
We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and our number is 800-348-2551. One more email, and then to the phones we will go. This is from Drew. Holy cow, hiatal hernia. About a month ago, I had a case of breakthrough COVID. It only sucked for 4 days, truthfully. The first 32 hours were the worst. It felt like walking pneumonia, migraine, kidney stone, mono, and a hiatal hernia. I had one way back in high school. Everyone around me as well. We all thought I was having a heart attack. Anyway, I don't expect this to be read on the air. Well, jeepers creepers. I have no question. I just think more people should be aware of the condition. So, four paragraphs, and at the end, I don't expect this to be read on the air. My bad, but also Drew's bad. Do you want to comment on that?
Hiatal hernia is quite common. It's where the top of the stomach kind of outpouches above the diaphragm. That can happen for a variety of reasons: aging, changes in weight, injury. Frequently, if the hernia is small, it does not cause symptoms. Sometimes if the hernia increases, it can cause more exacerbation of reflux symptoms. So if there's any concern of epigastric pain, which is pain right under the breastbone, or reflux symptoms, definitely come in and get checked out, and we can tell you if you have a hiatal hernia and how to treat it.
Now, can that be treated with drugs, or is that surgery only?
So for patients where reflux is existing with a hiatal hernia, our goal is to treat the reflux with medical management and prevent the patient from having to have surgery. In some cases, we cannot prevent the symptoms even with maximal medical management. And sometimes the hernia is so large that it's causing other problems. And in that case, patients would benefit from seeing a surgeon for a consultation.
You know, it's been a long time since my kids were babies, but I recall hearing when the first child was coming that, oh yeah, sometimes hiatal hernias happen in newborns. Is that true?
Hiatal hernia in newborn?
Or at least very young children.
I don't know about that. I treat 18 years and above, so I don't do pediatric GI. I'm not sure. I know newborns definitely can have reflux. Whether or not that exists with a hiatal hernia, I'm not familiar with.
We're joined today by gastroenterologist Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and let's hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie is in Glenmont. Valerie, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I have a tendency to choke when I eat like bigger pieces of meat, and I used to think that I have a little bump or, you know, in my trachea. I've looked down my throat. Of course, I found some little bumps at the end of my tongue. Should I see my gastroenterologist or should I see an ENT, and what could it be? Thank you.
Thanks, Valerie.
Hi, Valerie. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
So the feeling of choking when you eat could be multifactorial, meaning that there could have a gastrointestinal component. There could also be an ENT or ear, nose, and throat component. However, choking when you eat is definitely concerning. I would see your gastroenterologist to at least begin the workup. We can evaluate you by obtaining certain types of x-rays of the esophagus, as well as performing endoscopy to ensure that you do not have a narrowing or a stricture in the esophagus or some type of mucosal inflammation that could be contributing to that sense of choking. The bumps on the end of the tongue, I can't comment about. That's a little bit outside the scope of my specialty.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Valerie, thanks for the call. It's Medical Monday on WAMC. We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and our number is 800-348-2551. We go to lovely Mount Kisco, New York. Joy, you're on.
Hi. I'm in my 80s, and I wanted to avoid a colonoscopy. So when I went to Cologuard, it said Medicare doesn't pay for it. And I wonder if you're aware of, and that it would be a few hundred dollars, in what case would Medicare pay for it? Do you know?
Ah.
Hi, Joy. Thank you for calling. I don't know the answer to your question. That tends to be more policy and billing, which is not something I'm familiar with.
That's another show, and it's a tedious and terrible one.
Yes. It is. So, you know, The recommendations for screening for colon cancer. And screening means a patient with no symptoms, no personal history of colon cancer or polyps, no family history of colon cancer or polyps. We don't have screening guidelines after the age of 80. However, I talk to my patients on a case-by-case basis, and if they are healthy enough to undergo the procedure with sedation, I certainly would be happy to perform that.
Here's the thing about that, though. If you take it, and there can be false positives, false negatives, they're, yes. I guess they're pretty accurate, but if it's at all indicative of an issue, you have to have a colonoscopy anyway.
Correct. So, you know, I have encountered patients who have said they didn't want to have a colonoscopy. Their primary care physician ordered a Cologuard. It was positive, and then they did end up going to colonoscopy. But I have seen patients say, even if it's positive, I'm not going to have a colonoscopy. In that case, don't do the test.
Yeah. We're joined today by Dr. Jennifer Northrup, and we go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Is necrotizing enterocolitis caused by the same bacteria as necrotizing fasciitis?
Good Lord, that's a lot of syllables, Jim. Is necrotizing enterocolitis? I've lost it at that point, doctor. Do you have any clue?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for your question. There are several bugs that can cause both of those conditions. I don't know for sure if there is some overlap. That would be more the purview of an infectious disease specialist.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551, and we go to Burlington, Vermont. Paul, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, medical crew. Doctor, I've been having this issue for a couple of months now, where if I drink any alcohol at all, or if I eat anything slightly spicy, I start to have bloody discharge from my nose. I've had a nasal CAT scan. I've had an upper endoscopy, and nobody can seem to tell me what is causing this issue.
Hi, Paul. I'm sorry to hear this is happening to you. Bloody nose, or what we call in the medical profession epistaxis, again, would really be covered by an ear, nose, and throat physician. My scopes, we don't examine the nose. I'm not sure exactly why alcohol and spicy food ingestion is causing that to happen to you, but if you have not seen an ENT, that would be the next step.
No, I've seen her twice. I've had two nasal scans, as I said, and she's ordered a nasal CAT scan.
Okay. But I guess, doctor, you have no... Okay. We can't do anything on that one, Paul, but thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's talk for a second, just for a second, before the next call, about spicy food.
Yeah.
Some of us, I'm not saying who, but he might be in the studio with you, does get some indigestion from time to time, but spicy food doesn't do it. It never does.
Yeah. So that really is... on a patient-by-patient basis. You know, we have a traditional GERD prevention diet, although some patients say they're not bothered by things on that, and they're bothered by things that are not on that. So I really say to patients, go by your specific triggers.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. We go to Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Afternoon, doctor.
Hi, Jim.
Yes, I'm 77. I'll be 78 in January. I'm going to try to prompt my primary care physician to get a colonoscopy. I have had polyps before during those, and so was my mother, had a history of it, and she had diverticulosis or isis. I forget which it was she had. She had leaky bowel syndrome, had surgery to correct that. My younger brother, 6 years younger than me, he had a surgery to correct the leaky bowel syndrome. But my call primarily today is about the fact that the way people combine all kinds of foods, any kind of food in the same meal, may be a great cause, I think, of this over-acidity condition and the washing up in the esophagus. I was fortunate to get a book for my birthday several years ago from a cousin called Fit for Life, and it tells you to properly combine your foods. You don't eat animal protein foods in the same meal with highly concentrated plant carbohydrates, grain products, potatoes, things like that. So I took that practice up, and I would have my animal proteins in one meal with raw or cooked vegetables, salads, cooked vegetables, whatever. And another meal, if I want baked potato, I'll have two, three, or four, whatever. You're going to get all those foods in the, you know, in the same day, whatever. You don't have to combine them all in the same meal to make a, people call it a well-balanced meal. Well, the stomach is unbalanced. It's trying to put out acid that does that digest the animal foods, proteins, and then trying to put out alkaline substances to digest the highly concentrated plant carbohydrates. And it's like that old school project, putting baking soda into vinegar, and yeah, it just frosts right out.
Okay. Do you got a question for the doc, Jim?
Oh, yes. What was that procedure she was talking about, the name of it, that gives you a look at the entire intestinal tract or as much of it as possible?
Hi, Jim. I think you're referring to the wireless small bowel capsule endoscopy, and that is intended primarily to look at the small intestine.
Right. And that would only be if someone had, you know, symptoms of something being caused, a problem in that area. I guess they wouldn't do it for a general colonoscopy, would they?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Jim. We appreciate the call very much. By the way, you don't reuse those, do you?
Single use only.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go to the next caller, and we go to Shelburne Falls. And Lynn, you're on.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Is it Dr. Northrup or Northrum?
Northrup.
Northrum. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I've had chronic constipation now for some time. I'm 67 years old, and I lost, well, I didn't really lose my sense of smell. It got distorted, and my sense of taste got distorted after a concussion. And I mostly, you know, proteins. I am not getting a lot of fiber, but maybe that's what I have to do. Can you please help me?
Yes. Have you seen a gastroenterologist and had a colonoscopy?
I have had a colonoscopy, and I am dated to see one of those doctors in early December.
Okay, great. Well, Lynn, I'm glad that you called. You know, constipation definitely is something that we want to fix because of its impact on quality of life. Seeing a gastroenterologist is important because there's a lot of questions that need to be asked about your specific situation, including when did this start, a thorough review of all your medications and supplements because they can cause constipation, a thorough review of your family history, making sure that there's no structural abnormality for your constipation with a colonoscopy. And if all of that is negative, we do have medications that can be used to treat chronic idiopathic constipation. Some of them are over-the-counter and some of them are prescription.
Lynn, thanks a lot for the call. It's a Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Northrup joins us today. Let's grab at least one or two more before the next break. And who has been waiting the longest? Looks like Janice in Buckland. Janice, you're on.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. About a year ago, I experienced the most tremendous pain, like the other person you mentioned who said it was like childbirth. I was doubled over. I was in the emergency room in the hospital for 16 hours in the most excruciating pain of my life, doubled over, crying out, help me. Turned out that my intestines were twisted in two places and died. 10 feet of my intestines died in my body. And my gastroenterologist and the surgeon did not know what could have caused it to twist in two places, because I've heard it can happen in one place and then they'll take a couple inches to the right and the left of the twist. So do you have any thought at all as to what could have caused my intestines to twist in two places, my large intestines, and why would they have taken 16 hours to open me up? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Hi, Janice. I'm sorry that happened to you. Have you ever had any surgeries before this?
You know, tonsils, anal fissures, but nothing.
I should have specified
nothing like that.
Abdominal or pelvic surgery.
Nope.
Okay. So the most common reason for there to be a herniation or a twisting of the bowel is prior surgery. It is uncommon in someone who's never had a surgical procedure on the abdomen because there's no chance for scar tissue to occur. I can't, you know, specifically answer in your personal situation what might have caused that. Sometimes the why questions are the hardest.
Indeed. Well, Janice, thank you for the call. We have to take a break here. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Northrup joins us. Jennifer Northrup joins us on this Medical Monday. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop, Medical Monday today, gastroenterology with Dr. Jennifer Northrup on the program, and the number is 800-348-2551. A couple of emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones for the home stretch. Doctor, this one is from Jill. I have a question for the doctor. Good, I'm glad it's not from me because I have no idea. Jill writes, I had the transoral incisionless funduplication procedure in July of 2020. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, I'll continue then. There's about 9 more paragraphs. I suddenly started to have reflux and couldn't eat much of anything. It was discovered after endoscopy that I had a small hiatal hernia. Luckily, I did not have Barrett's esophagus. It seemed that my lower esophageal sphincter had failed. My question is, what could have caused the less to suddenly fail? I have read that antihistamines can cause failure. I have allergies, and I've always taken them. The TIF procedure worked well, and I am doing well. I'm actually part of a Johns Hopkins study of the effectiveness of this procedure, and that's from Jill in Queensbury.
Hi, Jill. I'm glad that you had success after the TIF. There's so many things that could cause lower esophageal sphincter weakness. It's really impossible to say. Antihistamines actually are used as part of an antacid regimen. So,
really?
Yes. So,
hold that thought. Continue with this answer, and then I have another question for you.
H2 blockers or histamine receptor blockers, which are the common anti-allergy medications, Claritin, Zyrtec, Pepcid, famotidine, have antacid properties. So I don't think that is the culprit, but there may be other specific things germane to your situation that may be playing a role that I'm not aware of.
What is this incisionless procedure, this TIF? What is that?
So it's a way to endoscopically try to prevent reflux, whereas traditionally, if you're going to send a patient for anti-reflux surgery, it's a big procedure. General anesthesia, incision, you take the bottom of the esophagus and you rotate it around. This is all done endoscopically, and it's new. I don't personally perform this procedure. We do have people in my practice who do, but it's showing quite a lot of promise.
I mean, surgery is something that I never had expected to be the end result of going in for an endoscopy. What percentage of your patients actually, you know, omeprazole or whatever will not cure what they have and they need surgery?
In my personal practice, very low, less than 5% end up needing surgery.
Dr. Jennifer Northrup joins us. One more email and then back to the phones. This one's from James. What method is used to check peristalsis? Could a sluggish peristalsis cause hemorrhoids? And that is from James.
Hi, James. That's a good question. So hemorrhoids are dilated blood vessels at the anus. Everybody has blood vessels there. When they get swollen, that's what we refer to as hemorrhoids, and that can cause a variety of issues. That can be exacerbated by chronic constipation, straining. Frequently, there is decreased motility in the colon or, you know, the slow peristalsis that can contribute to that. We do have a variety of ways to test for that. That alone doesn't cause the hemorrhoids, but the resultant constipation from the altered peristalsis can play a role.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Jennifer Northrup joins us, and let's go to Danbury, Connecticut. Albert, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question about Dexilant and Miralax. I take them every day, and the gastro doctor told me it's fine. I've been taking the Dexilant for about over 8 years because I have Barrett's. So is it common to do that, or will I have any side effects later on? Thank you.
Thanks, Albert.
Hi, Albert. Yes, so recommendations are lifelong PPI administration for patients with Barrett's esophagus because the risk of esophageal cancer is increased with that. There are side effects to proton pump inhibitors, and that depends on your personal history of other conditions, other medications, family history that should be reviewed with your gastroenterologist. However, in most cases, the benefit of PPIs outweighs the very low risk long term. And of course, when we're talking about trying to prevent a malignancy, that really trumps any very mild or minor side effect that can be managed by regular visits with your gastroenterologist.
Albert.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And now to Clifton Park. And Bob, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Ray. Hi, doctor. I had a quick question about probiotics. You mentioned them before. I have an ancient mother. She's 103, and she's had urinary tract infections quite often, and she's on antibiotics. And her primary care doctor told her to go on Saccharomyces boulardii and Rhamnosus GG. He just wanted to know what you had to say about those two specific strains and possibly others that would contribute to a healthy flora in the intestinal tract.
Hi, Bob. Well, God bless your mother, and you come from some hearty stock, so kudos to you.
Yes. Thank you.
I definitely think that's right. I definitely think probiotics are important in patients who are on chronic antibiotics for other conditions. However, not all probiotics are created equal. There are probiotics that are essential to the GI tract, others that are helpful for the sinuses, for the urinary tract, the vaginal colony. So in terms of gastrointestinal probiotics, I personally recommend Saccharomyces boulardii. I avoid the multi-strain probiotics, the ones that have 20 different strains. That tends to cause more GI upset, such as bloating, indigestion, gas. Okay. The single strain has proven the most gut-specific, and it's easy to take. It doesn't require refrigeration. It's one capsule a day. You can take it with food, without food. Right. Very easy to work into the regimen.
Should everybody be taking that?
No.
No.
I think if you don't need a probiotic, if you're not seeking to improve a specific symptom, I don't think it's necessary.
Well, Bob, congratulations on your mom. Now, do you ever actually call her ancient to her face? Do you ever say, hey, the ancient one?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
She's got a great sense of humor still. Yeah, right.
That's great,
she's
man.
She's got a sense of humor like yours, right? You're definitely an asset to WAMC.
Well,
I listen to you all the time.
Thank
so
you so much. I don't stand a chance of making 103, but I appreciate it, Bob. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Marion in Albany. Marion.
Yes, yes. Thank you both for being there. I've been on Nexium 40 milligrams daily for about 5 years, and I'm still waking up during the night with reflux, and sometimes it's pretty nasty, and I don't it doesn't go away for a really long time during the night. Would it make sense for me to have I forgot what the test is for esophageal cancer, because a friend of mine died from esophageal cancer without knowing he had it.
Yeah. Hi, Marion. I'm sorry to hear about your friend, and I thank you for your call. This is a very, very important question. And absolutely, patients on Nexium or other antacid medications who are unable to stop them for several years or having breakthrough symptoms such as you definitely should come in, see a gastroenterologist, and have an endoscopy to screen for Barrett's esophagus. And in your case, to make sure that your reflux is being optimally treated and that there's nothing else going on to cause your breakthrough symptoms.
I see. So could that possibly include an increase in the Nexium dosage from 40 to something higher?
It could include that. It could be adding in a different medication. The endoscopy would also look to make sure that there's not another condition at play in addition to gastroesophageal reflux disease that could be contributing to your symptomatology. So it would really be important to get a thorough look and make sure that your symptom, you know, are being appropriately treated and that we're not missing something.
And is it necessary to have a colonoscopy at the same time as an endoscopy?
Well, that depends on when you had your last colonoscopy. Have you ever had a colonoscopy?
Yes, but it was the Cologuard that's done through the mail because I'm low risk.
Okay, and how long ago is that done?
2 years ago.
Okay, so that's not, you're not, based on that, without knowing your other personal or family history, it does not sound like you're due for colon cancer screening, so that is not something that would automatically be done. However, if you were due for colonoscopy, we certainly can do both of those procedures at the same time.
Sure. Okay, well, how far in advance does an endoscopy have to be arranged?
Well, it depends on the practice, right?
Depends on the practice, but in your case, because you're having symptoms, I would recommend an office visit first, and then we would be able to set up an endoscopy or other testing that would be appropriate.
All right, Marion, thank you very much for the call. Just one quick question about reflux before we go to our next caller. When you diagnose someone with reflux, before you prescribe medication or anything else, do you say, hey, listen, a lot of this can be behaviorally controlled, drop 20?
Absolutely. Diet and lifestyle changes, behavioral changes, are the first step towards treating acid reflux disease. Unfortunately, those are not things that can happen overnight, certainly not in weight loss. And sometimes we recommend pills, medications right off the bat while patients are working towards weight loss, but that's certainly very important and they're really complementary.
Dr. Jennifer Northrop joins us today on the program. The number is 800-348-2551. We go to Enza in Wilbraham, Massachusetts. You're on.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Oh, good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask the doctor about, I have had GERD for quite a few years, but for some reason it's affecting my lungs. At night when I'm sleeping, even though I put several pillows in the back, which my back is suffering for it now, the acid or whatever it is mucus. I have lots of mucus that goes into my throat and it drips into my lungs, and I have asthma now. I've been seeing a pulmonary doctor and says that I have COPD. And I've been taking medication for that, but I have been taking a lot of every day for at least 2 or 3 years now. I've been taking pantoprazole or omeprazole. They change every once in a while. They say it's better to change a little bit once a day, 40 milligrams a day. And then this other doctor, I just moved from Florida, so I have a whole new set of doctors right here. I haven't seen a gastroenterologist yet, but
okay.
He said that if I take the sucralfate, 1 gram tablet twice a day, that if I have any kind of ulcers in my stomach or something, they might help out to heal.
Doctor.
I don't know, but anytime I go to see the doctor about it, I ask if it's a possibility that my asthma, I've ended up in an emergency room twice now. I couldn't breathe, so they pumped me up with lots of these pedrazone or whatever it is that they give you to start your breathing again. But is it a possibility, or am I just imagining it?
Hi, Enza. You're not imagining it. I frequently see patients with uncontrolled reflux. And what happens at night, we don't have gravity working for us. So the acid travels up into the esophagus and can be aspirated into the lungs, causing irritation, which can certainly exacerbate underlying conditions such as asthma or COPD. So it definitely sounds to me that you need to see a gastroenterologist locally to make sure that your reflux is being optimally controlled. Does not sound like it is, and that really needs to be addressed. But you're not imagining it.
Enza, thanks a lot for the call. If someone has that situation in the middle of the night, would you as a doctor say, well, the first thing you could do is sit up?
Yes. Sitting up right away. I like to recommend to my patients for immediate relief liquid Gaviscon, which is an easy over-the-counter medication. I recommend every human have it in their medicine cabinet because we're all going to get indigestion at some time, and it's nice to reach for it. I like the liquid form because it coats, puts out that fire, that burning in the esophagus until you can get to call our office the next morning.
Fair enough. All right, let's grab at least one or two more here before we wrap up with Dr. Jennifer Northrup. We go to Belchertown. Marie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could talk about silent reflux as it relates to my diagnosis of bronchiectasis. My pulmonologist did thoroughly work me up, and he also diagnosed, I was diagnosed with Sjogren's disease, and he believes that's what has given me the bronchiectasis. I never get heartburn, but I sometimes can feel a lump in my throat. My upper endo was normal. I mean, should I proceed with an esophagus workup since I've read that Sjogren's does affect the esophagus with the manometry and the pH testing? And I do worry that the silent reflux could be causing some bronchiectasis damage.
Hi, Marie. I'm sorry to hear that that's happening to you. Absolutely. Sjogren's is responsible for a lot of esophageal issues. Sjogren's is a rheumatologic condition where it causes dryness. And in the esophagus's case, abnormal peristalsis or movement, and that can worsen reflux. I'm glad your upper endoscopy was normal. Without knowing the specifics, I don't know if there were biopsies taken of certain areas of the esophagus, because that is important.
There were.
Okay, I don't
know.
They
were normal.
There was no microscopic inflammation?
Nothing.
Okay. So then in that case, I would recommend having the next step, which is a more thorough evaluation of the esophagus with a pH motility and impedance testing, which ties your specific symptoms to what your esophagus is doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot for the call. Now, we only have less than a minute here. So let's tackle this email that came in from Elizabeth, and I've always wondered about this as well. What is leaky gut?
So leaky gut is really another name for irritable bowel syndrome, which is a common functional gastrointestinal disorder. When we say that something is functional, it means that there's no structural abnormality. There's not a blockage, there's not a narrowing, there's not an ulcer, but the function of the gut is off. And the term leaky gut has come about because some of the newer studies and research coming out about irritable bowel indicate that there may be some channels where things are leaking through, nutrients are not getting properly absorbed. That's still a very kind of hot field right now. We don't have all of the answers, but there's a lot of research going on. So basically, leaky gut is a synonym for IBS or irritable bowel syndrome.
Well, Jennifer Northrup, that's where we will have to leave it. You did a super job today, and we really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Ray. It was my pleasure.
Support comes from Upstate Dermatology, providing Mohs surgery and dermatology services for more than 30 years in the Capital Region with offices in Clifton Park, Schenectady, Cobleskill, Scodac, and Chatham. UpstateDerm.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Jennifer Northrup of Albany Gastroenterology Consultants for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls and the emails. Many apologies if we didn't get to yours. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, is your car feeling a little dyspeptic? Well, Gordon Fricke joins us to help you sort out your automotive troubles tomorrow at 2 p.m. on Vox Pop. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.